Fastamai, hello and welcome to this episode of Agenda. I'm Ewan Gorn. How does looking for gas in the Manx seabed fit into the government's commitment to make the island carbon neutral by 2050? MHK Ralph Peake and MLC Jane Poole Wilson, members of the Climate Change Transformation Team, attempt to answer that question on the programme. And they could call men to arms, quell riots and light the beacons to warn of invasion. We speak to a new captain of the parish for Lonnon, Stephen Carter. The Manx government has revealed it's continuing to explore possible extraction of fossil fuels from the island seas, seeking technical and financial advice on how to do that for the find 8 to 10 miles off Macclehead, with local company Kroger at the heart of that process. This has angered the Isle of Man Green Party, naturally, who've slated the move. But Chief Minister Howard Quayle came on to defend the possible use of gas on mandate last week.
It's clear that as long as you do things to environmental standards, the UNESCO biosphere does not say you cannot do this or you will lose your UNESCO biosphere status. And that's what someone was trying to put forward.
But is it in keeping with the biosphere status?
Well, you have to look at what is the way forward for the Isle of Man. So I, as Chief Minister, have made a commitment to reaching net zero carbon emissions by 2050. Now, we are absolutely serious about that. However, the simple reality is, though, that fossil fuels will remain a part of our energy supply in the near future as we undertake what will be a monumental transition. Now, we've got a state-of-the-art power station that uses gas turbines that has a good 20 years of working life ahead. Now, at this stage, permission has been given to explore what actually exists, and there could be some potential benefits for the people of the Isle of Man. For example, we buy imported gas that's come from, I'm led to believe, from Norway, where the government has a taxation system, we'll call it royalties because they own it, and that's paid to the government, the Norwegian government, over 1,000 kilometres away. Now, if, and it's still a big if, we find gas that can be used in our territorial seabed, then it would be just a few kilometres to travel onto the island, so the carbon footprint of it is much lower, and royalties would be paid to the Isle of Man, which could in turn fund a new green electricity plant such as tidal or wind power for our long-term use.
Well, you talk about a few kilometres off the coast. Is this all connected to the Kroger plans, 8 to 10 miles off of Macclehead?
Yeah, well, Timwald's strategy, which was approved in 2014 by the previous administration, and we have in our programme for government, commits us to maximising the social and economic value of the island's territorial seabed. So whatever's in our seabed, is there a value and a use to help the Isle of Man going forward? And if we can use this as a transition, we're not saying it's going to be there for the next 100 years, we're saying if we can use this for a transitional period, then we can do what Norway have done. For example, Norway use their income from oil and gas sales to make it a world leader in the use of renewable energy and clean technology. So this is it's a transitional way forward. There's lots of ifs, but if it's found and if it's successfully can be brought onto the island, it could bring cheaper gas to the people of the Isle of Man, power our own gas turbines whilst we transform over to a new fully 100% green, and I've been energy source. I've been very passionate that personally one of my pet projects is we have a tidal race off the Point of Ayre which would generate electricity for 23 and a half hours a day, and the technology isn't maybe as efficient as you would want at the moment or cost efficient, and I've had meetings with the First Minister of Wales and I've had meetings with the Metropolitan Mayor of Liverpool who are looking and working on tidal developments to see if that technology will be suitable for the Isle of Man.
Chief Minister Howard Quayle there. But how does exploring for gas fit into the Climate Change Transformation Team's goals? That's a body of local and international experts who've been informing independently chosen Professor James Curran, who'll put forward a climate action plan next year. I put this question to two of the political members of the team, MHK Ralph Peake and MLC Jane Poole Wilson. But first, I asked them for an update on what's been going on with the plan.
The process has been underway now for getting on for 2 months, and there's been some massive amount of work been done by the team, and it really is a cross department team, cross-government team, it really is. We've got representations from each of the departments, which we're absolutely delighted with. They've been working very hard on that. And it really, the idea is to bring all that research from around the world, topics that really can make a difference, and it's going to be all that information we brought together, and the professor will actually be starting that work. Well, he'll actually look at those, and that will form the foundations for his independent report. That's the great thing. We'll have solutions that have been tried and tested elsewhere around the world, but they're really from a Manx point of view.
And when is that report due, just to be clear?
The report will actually be out in early January publicly, and it'll be debated in Tynwald.
Can you tell us a little bit about some of the themes that have been emerging, or would that be preempting what's going to come from the report?
We've had a few stakeholder and community workshops, and there has been a general openness around the sorts of themes. And in fact, last week we were up at Woodburn Road, and we actually had people looking at different themes. So the obvious themes are things like energy supply, renewable energy, the whole theme of education, so helping people understand not only more about climate change itself, but actually the what, you know, what can I do, what will make a difference, that type of thing, and particularly through our schools as well. Other key areas are obviously things like transport, things like buildings, land use, agriculture. So these are broad themes, and then within them there's analysis, or there will be analysis. I mean, it's still ongoing, but there will be analysis about the current situation, but what's possible, as Ralph says, particularly looking at what's already been tried elsewhere, what's available, what the costs are of doing some of it, what the benefits are, though, you know, what are the opportunities? So I think there's what we should see is Professor Curran's independent report that tells us what we can do, underpinned by huge amounts of research and local input from stakeholders and community about things that they're aware of, things that we could take into account, things that we've considered before we get to the point of saying, right, this is the Isle of Man's way forward.
Now, of course, your work isn't happening in a vacuum, and there are major events taking place on the island which will have major effect on the goals that the climate change commitment to carbon neutral by 2050, that there are things happening that will, of course, play a major impact in that. I'd like to ask you about the first one, which has emerged this week, the commitment to continue to investigate exploration and exploitation of hydrocarbons in Manx seas. Now, many members of the public might be wondering, doesn't this conflict directly with what the climate change transformation team is trying to produce?
Well, the great thing about the Isle of Man is, and one of the things that Professor Curran noted when he arrived here, first of all, was the richness of resources we have here in the Isle of Man, right in the middle of the Irish Sea. All this wind, we all know as local people how much wind there is here, and that's a massive resource, and it's really able to take what we can, what resources we can use in an environmental way.
And but does that include carbon? Does that include hydrocarbons that pollute the atmosphere?
There's lots of people who actually believe that all the hydrocarbons that are in the ground should stay in the ground. You know, that's a point of view that's been widely put about and accepted by people. It really is down to the professor to look at all these points, and I know that he will be addressing this and he will make a statement on that in his report.
But I mean, what do you say to people who say surely the continued investigation of using a polluting fuel is directly undermining the work you're trying to do to achieve carbon neutrality?
I understand that perspective. And yes, there is a perspective that says if you are about carbon neutrality and decarbonising, why on earth would you generate more, or why would you get your own carbons out of the ground? I think there's another perspective that says there's a transition to be done here. I think in transitioning, I don't think it's a question of saying this isn't really important and we've got to get on with it and do it as quickly as we can. The question is how we best do it. So we have to transition to renewables. There is no two ways about it. What I'm hoping for out of the report, and what I believe is a strong commitment from all of the team working on it and Professor Curran, is that we need an evidence basis for what is the way for the Isle of Man. So how quickly can we transition to renewables? What will be the right combination for the Isle of Man? And while we're transitioning, what is the best, what is the optimum way for us to transition and maintain energy security and reliability? Now, gas will continue to form a part of what we have to do for a period. Again, I don't want to preempt the output of this report, and I don't want to preempt how Tynwald will vote down the line. But I don't think we can switch everything off and switch on overnight. There will have to be some level of transition. The follow-on question from that is, well, how do we best manage that transition? Do we carry on in the way we are? Or is there any rationale and justifiable basis for, if we do have gas, and we don't even know that, but if we do have it in our territorial waters and we can extract that in a way that doesn't cause other problems, and these are all considerations that have to be thought about, is there any, is that part of the transition? Will that be a lower carbon footprint to go that way? Will we generate some income from it that we can invest in renewables to move that transition even more quickly? These are questions that I think require an evidence-based thought process and analysis.
I actually think that Timbal made the right decision by backing the amendment to not have a date in that title. I think that allowed the independent chair to have a clear piece of paper, if you like, to actually deliver his report, not constricted to a date, so he can be as ambitious as...
Well, we have, and in that motion it says ambitious target options. Mm. And, you know, I think the strong message to the analytical team is think broadly and ambitiously about what's available, what may be available, and what further analysis and information will be required to make those decisions about what we can do and how quickly we can do it.
Well, you mentioned transition, and that's used a lot in defence of possibly extracting carbons to fund the move to a no carbon or low carbon economy. But I mean, it's been put that that's like police selling drugs to fund the war on drugs. I mean, people may not be able to get over the direct contradiction in these two streams of work. I mean, can you understand why there's frustration?
Oh, absolutely. I can definitely see that. And people do feel very passionately about that. And that's why it's really important to get an expert in to really give us that evidence so we can then support that.
But doesn't the science say, for the majority of it, leave carbons in the ground? That's the best way of tackling the climate emergency.
Absolutely. The science does say that. And it also says you should stop using fossil fuels overnight. That would be quite tricky, wouldn't it, to try and stop it overnight? Mm. So it is trying to get that period to be ambitious as possible. You know, Norway, one of the leaders in a sovereign fund, you know, they're able to fund now renewable energy from hydroelectric schemes. But a lot of that has been funded from their oil exploration.
But obviously before these most more alarming reports, I mean, that's been the criticism of this is, yes, countries have used this model previously, but that was before we've had these most recent IPCC reports and all these scary conclusions from scientists.
And I absolutely understand the point. I think we are still faced with a reality that we have to manage this transition. Now, I think what the reports do are absolutely focus everyone's mind that this can't be a kick the can down the road option anymore. I mean, you know, I think probably one of our biggest challenges is that this body of knowledge about what's happening has been building up over years. And I, you know, Professor Curran, one of the reasons I think we found him such a worthwhile individual to come along as this independent voice is he's a climatologist. He's looked at the science. He's been looking at it for years. I think the world is catching up, this has to be top of our agenda. To get it right, though, to make sure we do it and do it as quickly as we can, we have to understand how we are going to do it. And we have to, I think, you know, we have to accept that there is some balance between making this transition, which I don't think anybody now really suggests is not something we have to do. Certainly in Tynwald, my sense is that people understand this is important and we have to do it. What we do have to do is understand exactly how we should do it. And at this point, whilst
But do the means justify the ends?
I think, you know, I don't think in the sense of there will be some element of carbon while we transition. You know, the question is, from a purist perspective, which I understand, does that mean that you don't extract any more at all?
But you say purist, but also scientific.
Yeah. Or do you say that is the evidence, but if there is gas there and there is money that flows from that, actually the Isle of Man will move away from hydrocarbons much, much more quickly because of that. Now, I don't know the answer to that. I don't want to preempt anything that the report will say, but I do want to have a thought out approach that puts addressing this front and centre and makes every effort to do it. And I want to see the evidence about how we can do it really well and as quickly as we can.
You're listening to Agenda on Manx Radio. The new captain of Lonnon Parish says it's a great honour for any Manxman to occupy the role. Stephen Carter was appointed by the Lieutenant Governor, Sir Richard Gosney, last week. He joins the 16 other captains of the parish, who, as we heard earlier, has ancient powers, include the authority to raise a militia, quell riots and light beacons to warn of invasions. The role is now largely ceremonial, though captains are responsible for calling requisition meetings if requested to do so by parishioners. I spoke to the newly appointed Captain Carter.
Well, my name is Stephen Patrick Carter, and I've just been appointed as the new captain of the parish of Lonnon, and I'm also a merchant navy captain and have been the harbour pilot at Douglas for the last 25 years.
Right, well, to start our chat, I thought we'd talk a bit about your life. You just touched there on some of the things you've been doing and obviously your recent appointment, but just tell us about your life, your work, your home on the Isle of Man. Tell us about you.
Right, well, I was born in Douglas in 1950, and for the first 25 years of my life I lived in Douglas, and then I moved to Lonnon, to Baldwyne, where I've lived ever since. But even when I lived in Douglas, I used to spend a lot of time in Lonnon. I was in my earlier days a member of Eastern Young Farmers Club. I was a secretary for a time of Eastern Young Farmers, and appeared in the Farmers' Concert for Eastern Young Farmers in my younger days. Even though I've pretty much gone to sea for a living, I have done one or two other things at different times, left the sea, but I've always gone back to it. But I have a lot of farming connections. My wife, Christine, her father, Bobby Farger, used to farm Ayrton at Crosby, and my wife's uncle, Harvey Briggs, who was a former captain of the parish of Onken, farmed at Ballyclmartin on the White Bridge. And the Isle of Man, I think, has always had a connection between farming and the sea from that point of view. In fact, my great-grandfather used to farm on the Richmond Hill at the Speak Farm and Ballycubbin Farm on the Richmond Hill. I was educated at King William's College. I've been interested in boats since a very early age. I had my first boat when I was 11 years of old age in 1962, and I owned fishing boats. I used to work on the boats going to Port Sodrick in the school holidays and on the Douglas Head Ferry. And then, as I say, once or twice I left the sea and did other things for a short while, but always went back to the sea. And 41 years ago now, formed the Laxey Towing Company, which I still run to this day.
Well, tell us a bit about the company, if you can.
Well, Laxey Towing is basically a harbour service company. We own tugboats and barges. We do all sorts of work for the likes of the steam packet and the ships that visit, the cruise liners that visit. And as part of that, 25 years ago, I was appointed the harbour pilot at Douglas. And in that time, I have piloted thousands of ships in and out, including the biggest ships ever to come alongside in Manx ports, the biggest cruise liners, the biggest of any sort of ship ever to come alongside in Manx ports. And so it's been a very interesting career, one which I'm still engaged in.
And you've been given this honour, I suppose, to become a captain of the parish. We had a chat just before we started this interview about why that may have been, but why do you think you've been elevated to this position, if you will?
Well, I don't know. It is a great honour for any Manxman to become captain of his parish. It is a great honour for my family, for my wife, my two daughters, my four grandchildren, and my mother, who's luckily still with us, although she's very aged, and my brother and sister and their families. It is a great honour for the family to be the captain of the parish. I also consider it's a great honour for the Merchant Navy, because I think, and I may be corrected on this, but as far as I'm aware, I am the first Merchant Navy officer to become captain of the parish in the Isle of Man. And obviously the role has been established for hundreds and hundreds of years, and that may not strictly be the case.
Maybe in recent memory, perhaps.
Perhaps in recent memory, I think that's a fair way of putting it, yes.
Many might not even know anything about what the captain of the parish is. What do you see the role as?
Well, originally the role of the captain of the parish was, it's encompassed in the oath that the captain has to take. The captain had the power to raise the militia to quell rioting, and also to, I think, if there was any invasions or anything else in the Isle of Man, to raise the militia to protect the Isle of Man. They were also empowered to assist the civil magistrates in maintaining the law, and I understand in recovering debt. These functions, of course, of the captains of the parish have obviously been superseded by the coroners and the police force, etc. But these were established, as I understand, in the days before we had coroners and before we had any sort of police force. So it is a very old role, I think, probably dating back to Viking times. These days, the primary role of the captain of the parish, I think, is to call a requisition meeting when requested to do so by the parishioners. And my understanding is that if 12 parishioners, and they have to be parishioners from the parish, write to you and you ask you to call a requisition meeting, and then it is the duty of the captain of the parish to arrange a venue and a suitable date and call that requisition meeting. Now, normally, requisition meetings are called at the time of a general election or possibly a by-election, if there's a by-election in a sheeting, in order so that the candidates can express their views and be questioned by the, express their views to the parishioners and be questioned by the parishioners.
And you as the captain would be chairing that meeting?
That is absolutely correct, yeah. The captain of the parish chairs the meeting. But it is not exclusively for elections. If 12 parishioners, just say for the sake of example, there was a very contentious planning issue in a parish, then it has been, in fact it has happened in London with the previous captain, that there have been requisition meetings where the contentious planning issues were aired in public and various views were put forward so that people knew at least where they were.
Is the role then, barring perhaps the involvement in public life with the calling of requisition meetings, largely sort of a ceremonial role at this point? I know the captains gather on Tynwald Hill, they have the big chain of office which sets them out, but are there any other duties that set you apart?
I think you're probably right. I think that it is very much these days, ceremonial might be too grand a term, I suspect, but the captain is there to, he gets invited and will attend as many local functions.
So like a figurehead perhaps? Or
possibly, yeah. possibly that's the case, yes, yes. And I do feel, as I said before, that it is a great honour to be the captain, but I also feel that I'm very lucky, because I think in London that there were certainly a number of people who would have been equally as good at being the captain of the parish. Well, sorry, that's a little presumptuous. I don't. but who would be equally as eligible, shall we say, to be appointed captain of the parish? So I'm very proud to have been appointed.
And of course, you take up the mantle from your late predecessor, who was much loved by the community.
Yes, the previous captain of the parish was Jack Farragher from Ballacore Farm in Lonnon, and I've known Jack for a long, long time and was friends with Jack for a long, long time, and Jack was a very great captain of the parish of Lonnon, and if I can follow in Jack's footsteps, I shall be doing very well, I think.
Yours is a crown appointment, I believe, or through the lieutenant governor. I'd just like to ask, how were you told by him, could you be the next captain of Lonnon Parish?
Well, basically, the ADC to the governor, Diane Kelsey, contacted me and asked me if I would be available to sort of go for an afternoon tea with the governor at Government House, and she did. Not exactly say what it was for.
Cryptic, maybe.
Possibly. And anyway, I was invited to afternoon tea at Government House by His Excellency, and His Excellency at that point asked me whether I would consider taking over from the late Jack Farragher, and which obviously I accepted the greatest of pleasure.
And now it's an historic role. Do you think that the role will continue to change? It has changed already. I mean, I anticipate you probably won't be raising any militias in your tenure, but do you think the role needs to keep changing? And is it important to have it? Because some might question why we've still got captains of the parish.
Well, that's a very fair question, actually. But I would say that the Isle of Man is steeped in traditions of all sorts. And how many places have officials, the office of which can go back nearly 1,000 years? It is part of the Isle of Man's, one of many great traditions in the Isle of Man. And I have always been a great traditionalist in all sorts of ways. I would think it would be it is not something which is causing anybody any problems, I wouldn't imagine. And I would be very sad to see the role of the captain of the parish abolished. And it may, in time, evolve, as these things always do. But I would suspect it is a slow process. You might get some people who wanted to abolish the Tynwald ceremony, for instance, in its entirety. But once again, it is part of the traditions of the Isle of Man. And we do, after all, have the oldest parliament in the world with all these traditions. So I would sincerely hope, that there will be many, many more captains of parishes who follow me on when my time is finished.
Politics and the region of politics has become a very divisive place in recent years. You won't be calling any militias to quell any riots or anything anytime soon, will you?
Well, not unless circumstances dictate it. And one watches the antics of the Parliament in Westminster, which is really... Firstly, I don't think that the captain of the parish should get involved in politics. I think the captain of the parish should take a neutral stance, no matter whatever his personal views might be. But you could almost envisage the situation where if certain other people became prime minister and certain political parties might like to put a lot of pressure on the Isle of Man, might like to see the crown dependencies done away with altogether and become part of the UK. I think that there may be occasions there when a large proportion of the population of the Isle of Man might not be too happy. But whether it would go as far as needing to raise a militia is another question.
The new captain of Lonnon Parish, Stephen Carter. That's all from this programme. We'll be back with more from Agenda soon, and you can listen again to this episode online via the Manx Radio website and via Spotify as a podcast. But for now, gurumayu and goodbye.